Good morning and welcome to Frankly Speaking. Today we'll be discussing the insanity plea. What is its future? I'm Helen Ackerman for George Mason University. Few courtroom decisions have caused the shock, consternation, and sense of outrage that the verdict in the Hinckley trial has done. Many feel that the not guilty by reason of insanity verdict has made a mockery of the law when millions saw Hinckley shoot the president and the others on national television. The insanity defense has been the subject of controversy in the past, but now it is really under fire. With us today to discuss the insanity plea and the possibilities of changing it is Robert P. Davidow, Professor of Law at the George Mason University School of Law. Why do you think people are so upset about the results of the Hinckley trial?
I think the reason is that, unfortunately, a large number of people really don't understand what a crime is. I think a lot of people tend to think that a crime is the act and nothing more. But as any first-year law student learns, a crime, in most instances, consists of two elements. It consists of the act, and then it also consists of the state of mind, the mens rea, the guilty mind. I think that in order to understand this, we have to go back a little bit and understand what it is the insanity defense is. The insanity defense addresses the second element. It does not address the act, and of course in the Hinckley case the act was admitted. Mm-hmm. It addresses the second element, the state of mind. Now it is possible, of course, and some people do take this view, to look at the mental element very narrowly and to think of it only as an intention to carry out a particular goal. I think really historically this is inaccurate. I think that mental element is more broadly conceived of as the element of blameworthiness. And I'll tell you why I think that. If we look at a couple of other defenses, namely the defense of infancy and the defense of duress, we will see, I think, that they have something in common with the insanity defense, and that is that in all cases we're talking about a lack of blameworthiness. For example, a child at the age of 6 may be capable in the narrow sense of intending to hurt someone, of intending to hurt a parent, for example,
right.
And may be capable of putting poison in a glass of water and handing it to the parent. Nevertheless, at common law, that child conclusively was presumed to be non-responsible for the act. Why? Because the child was so young that it was thought the child was really not responsible, could not maturely consider what was going on. All right. Also consider the question of duress. If a person is threatened with death, unless that person takes the wallet of another person, for example, the person who is threatened may, in a narrow sense, intend to take the wallet. And that intention, in a very narrow, superficial way, may be the kind of intention that would be sufficient for conviction of larceny. However, that person is not guilty. Why? Because the person is doing that act to avoid a greater harm, namely the death of himself or herself. And there, that person is not guilty because the person is not thought to be blameworthy. In the same sense, I think, the person who succeeds with the insanity defense does so because of a judgment, and often this is the judgment of a jury, as in the Hinckley case, that person really is not blameworthy with respect to those acts. Now, I think if people understood that, there wouldn't be quite such an outcry. It's always possible, of course, to disagree with the jury verdict in any particular case. But this could be true in cases that have nothing to do with the insanity defense. I don't think there's anything peculiar about members of the public being upset with the decision of the jury. But, of course, you also have to remember that those jurors sat there for a considerable length of time hearing a lot of evidence which most people did not hear. And so before we jump to the conclusion that the jury is wrong, I think perhaps we ought to go and study the transcripts and see what was actually said by the various witnesses.
Well, one of the things that the jury heard in this trial was a lot of expert psychiatric evidence. And part of the problem of people's conception of that is that the psychiatrists gave very contradictory evidence. And there is a feeling, I think, among the general public that as long as the defendant is rich enough to be able to shop around, he or she can find a psychiatrist to certify that they are insane, and often genuinely so. Do you think this is an unfair view of the role of psychiatric evidence in the courtroom?
Well, first, I don't think the problem of being able to get experts is peculiar to the insanity defense. In lots of other cases, if the person is rich enough, the person can hire a very fine lawyer and can get experts to help, for example, in such a thing as the selection of the jury. In a very simple kind of case, a person who is rich, for example, can go and get psychologists and other experts to help in the selection of a jury. So that the advantage that a rich person has in this situation is not peculiar to this situation. Now, as far as the conflict in testimony is concerned, the insanity defense cases are not the only cases in which there is a conflict in testimony. You have a very common situation, for example, in which the defendant, for example, in a robbery case, gets on the stand and says, I was not in the bank at the time of the robbery. I was home watching TV. And perhaps his wife and children will get on the stand and say the same thing. And then you have people who were in the bank say, no, the defendant was there in the bank. You have a conflict of testimony, and the jury has to resolve it. I really don't see any basic difference between the two. Now, it's true that you're going to have the use of experts in the insanity area, and you're going to have some rather...
These are meant to be dispassionate witnesses, however, which is not quite the same as the example
I don't think that the witnesses in the case that I'm talking about are necessarily dispassionate either. For example, the defendant is obviously an interested party. The defendant would like to get off. So the defendant is not necessarily a dispassionate observer. The wife and children may not be dispassionate either because they have a close family relationship to the defendant. It's possible that the prosecution witnesses may have an interest as well. It may be that the prosecution witness in the first instance thought that the defendant was the one. And now, since the witness has committed himself or herself to this proposition, he or she does not want to be seen as being in error. And so that person has a built-in bias to continue to insist that he or she was right in the first place and that the original identification was correct. So I really don't think it's correct to say that in these other cases, the witnesses are necessarily unbiased.
Well, it's a perception, particularly in psychiatric cases, because you do, it appears as though you get two sets of expert witnesses that flatly contradict each other, and these witnesses are meant to be professionals whose opinion is unbiased, and it does seem to be a characteristic of these cases.
Well, it certainly can happen, but again, I don't think it's peculiar to this case, and I think any attorney who has represented a person accused of crime or any prosecutor who has been in court representing the state or the government knows that in lots of cases, witnesses have a motive to falsify.
What do you think of the changes that are being suggested in the law? For instance, the replacement of not guilty because insane with guilty but insane.
I think what I said earlier about the criminal law and what constitutes a crime is an answer. And the answer is that conceptually it makes no sense whatsoever. Because, as I have said, a crime consists essentially of two elements. It consists of the act, and it consists of blameworthiness with respect to that act. The proposals to create something called guilty but insane would treat the crime as consisting merely of the act. The question is, why should you do that in this particular case and not do it with regard to other situations? Why should you not say in every homicide case, therefore, that the prosecution merely has to prove the act of the killing, and the defendant has the burden of proving an absence of the requisite state of mind, whatever that is, intention to kill, intention to inflict grievous bodily harm, reckless indifference to the value of human life, whatever the pertinent state of mind is, why not cast upon the defendant the burden of proving an absence of that state of mind? Well, you could do that, but if you did that, you would destroy the criminal law as we know it. That conceptually makes no sense at all. The criminal law identifies conduct that society has said is intolerable, so intolerable that if people deliberately engage in it or engage in it under certain circumstances, we're going to say that they are blameworthy, we're going to put them in jail. If you take away that blameworthiness element, it seems to me you have deprived the criminal law of its reason for existing, and you might as well go to a system which has been proposed by some in which you simply try to identify people who are likely to commit undesirable acts in the future, violent acts. And you could do that if you wanted to. Simply eliminate the criminal law at all and simply identify people who have or are likely to commit antisocial acts. The problem, of course, is that you have to then predict who is going to commit these acts. And psychologists and psychiatrists have a great deal of difficulty in making those kinds of predictions. So you would end up with one of two things. You would either have a huge number of people behind bars in order to make sure that no harmful acts were committed, Or you'd have only a few, but you would end up not having the few who would, in fact, as it turned out, commit the antisocial acts. So that is the dilemma if you go to a predictive scheme.
Now, five states have already introduced this plan, the guilty but insane plea. How is it working in those states?
I really don't think I'm competent to say. It's difficult. I've taught the substantive criminal law on a number of occasions, but I'm not doing that now. And
there are 51. It is a fairly recent change,
relatively recent,
isn't it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I could really really competent to say. But you have to remember also, when you talk about how well is it doing, that the insanity issue is raised in such few cases anyway. So mm-hmm. it's such a small, minute proportion of the total number of criminal cases that it's likely that whatever is done is not likely to have much an effect upon crime in the particular jurisdiction. But I think the insanity defense is nevertheless important because it does force people to think about what the criminal law is all about. And I see the danger as this, that if people take the easy way out and say, well, in this case, we're going to attach consequences to the act and forget about the blameworthiness aspect, that this will run over into other areas and there will be the tendency to think of a criminal act as merely the act itself and not as the act plus blameworthiness. This would lead to a greater use of strict liability in the criminal law. And strict liability in the criminal law does not make any sense.
Would you explain that?
Yeah. Because the law, as it has developed, has involved an act plus blameworthiness, if you take away the blameworthiness, you've taken away the presupposition of the criminal law. If you take away blameworthiness, you're saying that any antisocial act may be punished, and you're going to broaden considerably the number of people to whom the criminal law can apply.
Such as?
You are going to cheapen the criminal law, for example. Traditionally, the criminal law or a criminal conviction is something that people would avoid because of the stigma. If everybody is subject to the criminal law, then there's no stigma.
But give me an example of who would come under the criminal law under those circumstances.
Well, it would depend upon how far you want to go. For example, you could say, well, if you have a homicide, you have a killing of one person by another, you could place upon the defendant the burden of proving that there was no intention. This, I assume, could apply, for example, in all kinds of homicides with motor vehicles, for example. It could apply to lots of killings that are now, for example, might result in a decision of self-defense or a verdict of self-defense, not guilty by reason of self-defense. There are lots of situations in which people could get caught up in circumstances in which they would end up being convicted, who would not now be convicted. You have many more people subject to the criminal law. And I think that what this would do would be to cheapen the criminal law. If people do not believe that there is some special category of persons who are deserving of blame, and if it can be applied to everybody, then again, the stigma is gone, and the deterrent value of having such a thing as the criminal law is lessened to a considerable degree.
That's a very interesting perspective that you've brought up there. I'm afraid we're out of time. Professor David Oh, it's been great having you on the show, and what you've said has been extremely interesting. You've been listening to Frankly Speaking, a public service program produced by George Mason University, production coordinator Jean Hyde. For information about our guest or this program, please call area code 703-323-2138. I'm Helen Ackerman for the State University in Northern Virginia. Thank you for listening.